not perhaps to go into great detail, because that will be the subject of future discussions, but in a sense to give you an overview of what the course will be all about, the kinds of questions that may be raised later on. In other words, conceivably, I will not give you answers. As a matter of fact, I won't have time to give answers, but that the answers, if there are any, will emerge during the course of the subsequent discussion in this quarter. My task, in other words, is to ask ourselves, what is the crisis? And I prefer to reword this topic by changing it to read, what are the crises? In my judgment, there are four interrelated crises. How you relate them, of course, is going to be part of the subject of the term. But for a few moments now, I would like to consider what these four crises are, and then perhaps suggest some of the problems of interrelating and some of the kinds of answers that may emerge during the term. Now, the first crisis, not necessarily in terms of order of importance, but in terms of certainly centrality, is what some people call the population resources problem. The background of this kind of a crisis, I suppose, can be looked at in the first place in terms of the way population has grown in the world since the so-called Industrial Revolution began in the 18th century, or whenever it began. We can quarrel about its exact beginning. Roughly, let's cite a few population figures to show how the explosion exploded. Down to 1830, according to some estimates, of course we don't really know, but these are estimates, the population of the world as a whole reached 1 billion souls. That is, from the beginning of prehistory to 1830. It takes that long a period to reach 1 billion people. And throughout most of that period, the population of the world presumably was much, much fewer people, many, many fewer people than 1 billion. When you reach the level of a billion, you've reached really a high watershed, I suppose, the population from the viewpoint of our great, great, great grandfathers. In other words, the general assumption is that it goes somewhat like this. This is 1830, then, and this is prehistory in some sort, whenever man emerges as man, depending on how you define what man is, that the great beginning of the explosion is relative, is during a period of relatively few generations before 1830. Now, the interesting thing is that the next billion souls are reached in the next 100 years. How many thousand years this would be depends upon your view, you see, of human evolution. The next, in other words, what you get now is an enormous spurt. By 1930, the population of the world had reached 2 billion, you see, in 100 years. It's almost fantastic. Then, I don't know, see, I run out of space. I did this deliberately. As you push this further, you get a further accentuation. In 1960, you get the third billion. This is within 30 years. How you do that on a graph, I'll leave up to you. You can make your own graph, you see, to show it much more graphically than I have.
And now we're well on the way, you see, through the fourth bend. We're way up in the tree, over the tree bend. Right? You notice then how the acceleration has taken place. Now, population, of course, per se, presumably, cannot be viewed in an isolated fashion. It has to be related to something else before it becomes a crisis. What are some of the things to which it must be related, presumably, to make it a crisis of some kind? Well, it has to be related, of course, to means of subsistence, presumably, for one thing. Resources that are available for support of a population. And secondly, it has to be related in another way, I suppose you can say, to resources. That is to say, conceivably, you could support a population. Colin Clark, the economist, estimates a population of 29 billion you could support at the present standard of Holland, let's say. Whether he's right or not, I don't know. But this is what he estimates. But even if you could support a population for a relatively long period at the standard of living of Holland, another problem, of course, arises aside from that. What would the 29 billion people do with space, living space, you see, in the process? Here you enter a social dimension and a political dimension of the rate of the relationship between population and resources. We have studies which tend to show that if human beings become more and more crowded, for example, together, they take on certain characteristics that are usually regarded as undesirable. They tend to become irrational. They tend to become erratic. They act more like mobs, so to speak, other things being equal, than they do like human beings. Like human beings supposedly should act. Now, this is a value judgment, of course, about what a human being should be. As a matter of fact, the crisis arises because of value judgments, in a way. It becomes a crisis because we believe it's desirable for human beings to live and to live well, let's say. This is the assumption that we have behind this term crisis. Now, take an example. Take myself. I'm 6 feet four. And I know that when I get into a crowded condition, I know exactly what happens to me. I tend to get very nervous and irritable and so on. This is exactly what the studies tend to show. You know, even if you could assume that you could support me physically and 28,999,999,999 other people, you see, you would still have this second meaning of the problem of resources, that sheer space and its effect on our relations, social and political relations, in the process. So in these two senses, you see, we have to talk about resources in relationship to population. We can't confine it simply to what we would normally say would be the economic support of a large population. That's just the beginning. The second kind of relationship would be the social and the political. What effect it would have on the social and political if we keep going in this way. There's a third sense, it seems to me, in which we have to look at the relationship between population and resources. And that is in the context of an explosive technology. Highly industrialized nations, for example, which constitute still only a minor, perhaps a third of the world at the present day, but the rest of the world is rapidly trying to be highly developed. In this sense, the crisis exists because in the last 150 years or so, as our technological explosion has grown, we've come to believe that somehow our wants must be expanded too, you see. Now, part of this is due to the economic and political system to which I want to turn later. But the fact remains that there is a tendency in highly industrialized nations to make our what we think is necessary, our food and clothing and other material things that our desires seem to have magnified greatly. Not only does the population grow, but with technology, our desires for more and more of what the earth produces are magnified. So that you get a combination, you see, of population growth in relationship to resources and to a magnification of human desires. The result is that in terms of the toll on human resources, the Americans, for example, are much greater exploiters of natural resources, even though they have a smaller population, than India, you see. If the population of India be regarded as 500 million, which is about right, I think, today, we say, oh, those poor Indians, you know. They ought to use birth control. But notice, in the United States, the population is 200 million, roughly. But each of these 200 million will consume 20 to 30 to 40 times more, depending upon how you estimate it, of the Earth's resources than an average Indian will, you see. Well, now, you just take a little arithmetic, multiply this 200 million, let's say, by 30, you see, what do you get? You get in the United States a population of 600 million people. You see, it's more than the population of 600 million. That would be 6 billion. 6 billion people. I thought I was underestimating you. 6 billion people, you see, in the United States in relationship to the rate of consumption of the Indians. So that if you're going to tell the Indians, now you better use birth control, what are you going to say about 6 billion people, consumer equivalents, if you want to call it, to the Indians? What advice are you going to give to them then? So that there's a differential exploitation here in the relationship between population and resources that constitutes itself a crisis. How long can the so-called developed nations go on in this direction? Of course, the United States consumption is much greater than that of many other developed nations, but Sweden and Canada are other high consumption nations. And if you assume the Indians and the others all won't catch up with us, where does it end, you see? So that the problem at this level becomes not only how you can control population, but how do you control consumption rates? You see? How do you keep from magnifying human desires almost infinitely? As well as the question of space and relationship to the society and the polity. These are all ramifications of what I'm calling the population resources crisis, which I'm calling the first crisis. Then, now let's turn to the second crisis. Then, how would we formulate the second crisis? I call it the environmental crisis. This has many meanings, of course. But generally speaking, as technology explodes, and from the very beginning, of course, human beings have been technological animals. This is one of their characteristics as human beings. They seek to extend their physical powers by inventing machines of various kinds or devices. So that in a sense, you see, an airplane is simply an attachment we hook onto our bodies to enable us to move around faster than we cast it aside. It's an extension of us. And while other animals have some technological capacity,
the difference in degree between human beings and other animals, I should say, is so great as to become a difference in kind. So we say that human beings are technological animals par excellence. They're tool-making animals, in other words. Now, what's wrong with making tools, of course? One of the problems, of course, is that if the technological development is relatively low level, conceivably, there's nothing wrong from an environmental point of view, because the environment is sufficiently broad and sufficiently varied that the relative level of technological development doesn't affect the surroundings as much as if it becomes, of course, magnified enormously. Now here again, there is a kind of chart, you see, in terms of human development, which would roughly say that the rate of technological growth, now I'm not trying to be very exact here, but down to 1830, I'd say, is relatively slow. There are technological changes in every generation. Don't get the idea that you never have a generation in which there aren't technological changes. The ancient world, for example, was on the verge of the steam engine. It just didn't quite catch on, you know. But in principle, a model steam engine was invented in the days of the Roman Empire, for example. But and even the Middle Ages, which we think of as a static period, new tools and new devices were invented. For example, there's a very interesting story about the history of the plow, how it becomes more effective as a tool for the cultivation of the land during the Middle Ages. But again, it's a relative matter, you see. So down to about 1800, or thereabouts, the chart goes literally up a little bit here, about like this. And then what you begin to get, you see, is a compounded acceleration. Invention in the beginning was more or less sporadic. You know, someone was curious and he stumbled on a new technique. But as you move into the latter part of the 19th century, and particularly in the 20th century, invention becomes organized. You see, you deliberately try to organize for inventing new things, new tools. And so the steep rate of technological growth sort of parallels the growth of population in a way. And we don't see any end to it. Now, along with technological growth, then, what happens in terms of the environment? Well, generally speaking, it is, other things being equal, in the absence of an awareness of the question, the tremendous consumption of energy involved in the growth of technology will tend to pollute the air, the rivers, to consume vast quantities of natural resources. And again, this is accelerated, you see, even in the last 40 or 50 years. And generally speaking, to corrupt, I suppose you could use the term, if you understand what it means, the house within which man dwells. It would be as if you were living in a big house, for example, and you absorbed all the smoke, you see, that came out of the fireplace. It didn't go off into the air. It simply was retained in the house, because that's literally what ecology means, you see. It means the house that surrounds us, so to speak, the study of the house that surrounds us, the environment. Now, of course, it does this to the environment. Our burning of coal and our burning of and our consumption of other forms of energy. It does this in a context where men, you see, are still thinking in these terms. And they're still thinking in terms of the period before the great acceleration began. We still tend to think, don't we, quite often today, that air is a free good. There's so much of it, you see. So we don't have to worry about controlling the air. This was perhaps appropriate during this period. But you see, the technological explosion has become so great now that the air is no longer a free good, so to speak. It's subject to exhaustion, as it were, you see, because of the pollution problem. And we used to be able to think, before the great days of explosion here, we used to be able to say, well, what the Russians do with their air is their business. What we do with our air is our business. Can't say that anymore today. Mr. Andrei Sakharov, the Russian physicist, says, for example, in his little book called Coexistence, in which he discusses this problem, he says that already Russian air probably is polluting American air, you see. And American air is polluting Russian air. The world, you see, is driven more and more together. So that what the Russians do to pollute the water and the air affects the United States and vice versa. Now, you can argue that this process, then, of technological explosion and pollution and destruction of natural resources, some of which apparently are irreplaceable, are for which it's very difficult, if at all, to find substitutes, although there's going to be a big debate about that question, you see. You can argue that we've reached a stage already in this problem of the relationship between technology and the environment, that we've reached a crisis, perhaps even greater than the crisis associated with the first crisis I've been talking about, although they're obviously very closely related. Well, what should we do about man's environment then, in which he is developing? Should we reduce the level of technology? Or is it possible that new technology will solve the problems created by past technology? You see, there are two lines of thought here, which will be developed this term on this point, I think. At least two lines of thought. One line of thought says, well, if we get together enough, we'll discover new sources of energy. If copper is going to run out in the next 30 years, which some people predict, for example, no more copper, you see, we'll discover a substitute of some sort. What, I don't know what it will be, but we'll discover it. Because our scientists and our technologists are clever, and we'll get substitutes for it. I heard a paper at the American Association for Advancement of Science last December, for example, in which the scientist was saying, you're all too pessimistic, you see, about this problem. Man has always discovered, through his technological capacity, solutions for old problems. And he'll always do so in the future. And someone said, how do you know this? How can you extrapolate, you see, from the past into the future? And the answer of this very well-known scientist was, we can reduce the cost of going to other planets and we'll discover new sources of energy there, you see. This was his general answer to that problem. So that there's one answer, you see, to the question of technology and the environment, which goes somewhat like this. True past technological development, together with certain attitudes and population growth, have led to the present crisis. But the technologists can discover new technology which will overcome such issues as pollution, destruction of resources, and will find substitutes, presumably, for the energy, the many types of energy now being exhausted. The energy that we get from oil, you see. The energy that we get from coal. And those who think in these terms would say perhaps we can use solar energy directly instead of using it indirectly, you see, through coal and oil. In other words, this is a technological answer. We will discover an answer, somehow. Then there's the more pessimistic kind of view, on the other hand, which will say, but we've reached a situation today where technological answers alone are not sufficient. We have to discover other kinds of answers in the social area, in the legal area, in the political area, in the psychological area. We have to rethink our whole view of life in a way that we can't rely on technology. As a matter of fact, this school will, alone at least, this school will say, generally speaking, that in a sense, every time you find a technological answer to a problem created in part by technology, then there will be a new problem created by the new technology, which will lead to a new problem created by the new technology, and so on, so that you never catch up, you see, unless you combine technological discovery with drastic alterations in your whole attitude to life and the institutional structure, you see, within which you live, the political and the social structure within which you live, and even your religious beliefs might be involved, you see. Those who argue this last point will often say that there are two views that religionists have had about the environment and its relationship to technology. The one view is presumably reflected in Genesis, where it is said man is commanded to become dominant over the fish in the sea and the birds in the air and to control them for his own purposes. You see, this kind of view might be called the notion of conquering nature, you see, and subduing it. And nature, there are no limits to which you can exploit nature. No limits at all. You just keep going on and exploiting it. This would be, in a sense, the view, I suppose, of the optimistic scientist whom I quoted. The other view, the other religious view, in a sense, of this, would say that there are limits, in a way, to which man can exploit nature without having nature react and destroy man, as it were. And you can get off into a very interesting theological discussion at this point. You see that the problem of the environment is related to many facets of life, philosophy and theology and religion, as well as technology and the social sciences. Well, I won't have time to go into those issues. I hope you will be going into them at some time in the future. Now, a third kind of crisis that we confront, I'm calling the crisis in society and politics. In the Western world, we have tended to think of technological development as an inevitable given or fact about which we can do nothing. But once you get this process started, it goes on and on and on and on and on. It's sort of like nature, presumably, which has its own laws. And up till very recently, we have talked in that way. You probably still hear people say, don't you? Well, the coming generation will produce, and you fill in the gap, travel to Mars, or new sources for heating the house, and so on, or new types of houses, whatever it might be. And so our sole task as human beings, then the response is to adjust to the inevitable, you see. This is one view of the process. The technology cannot be controlled. All we can do is to control ourselves to adjust to technology. And this is a very ubiquitous element in the crisis, really, of society and politics, you see, because this is so deep in the way we think. We say we can change the Social Security laws, let's say. But who ever thought of debating in a presidential election the issue of how much more technology do we want to introduce? And yet, the technological explosion, see, changes our way of life far more drastically than anything the communists can possibly think of. You think of what the technological explosion has done in the last 150 years. It's depopulated the countryside. Some of you have read Oliver Goldsmith's great poem, The Deserted Village. You see, well, this has simply been dramatized for the last 150 years. It's depopulated the countryside. It's forced people into new occupations, forced them to give up their old occupations. It's uprooted them from their dwelling places and forced them to become mobile. See, these are all ways you're compelled to adjust to the technological imperative. Now, the question for society at this point is, do we want to adjust human beings to technology in this way, or is there some way that we can force technology to adjust to our wishes? Recently, for example, there was a report by a task force in the Department of Agriculture, which I think illustrates this attitude. It was looking at farming in the United States. And it advocated in its report the elimination of all attempts to subsidize, let's say, the family farm, as over against large-scale farming. And it said we ought to allow market forces, you see, to determine these things, so that if new technology is introduced and it's so expensive that only a large group can own it to farm, that will drive out still more family farmers. And the report said, make the sole test immediate economic gain, low cost per unit in production. Don't consider social factors, you see, whether it's desirable as a way of life to have family farms. Now here's an example of that kind of thinking, that you let economic forces and technological forces dictate what you're going to do, you see. Now that is a very serious crisis then. To what degree should technological development be regarded as a constant to which social values and institutions must adjust? And to what extent can we or should we force technological development to conform to our independently arrived at moral, social, and political values? What changes in institutions are essential to direct technological development if we reject accidental or hit or miss introduction of technology? Because you see, the issue becomes one then of to what degree do we want our affairs to be determined by accident, and to what degree do we want to try to reduce the element of accidental development of technology, and to control for our own purposes. The problem was dramatized, of course, early in the 19th century. Some of you know by Mary Shelley's novel called Frankenstein, you remember. This is one of the earliest satires, as you will, on technology. The argument is, you see, that we stumble upon all kinds of technology, including the technology that destroys us. And Frankenstein was the man who invented this monster, who then began turning upon his inventor, you see. Now there's a whole literature dealing with this problem of how, if we allow technology to develop blindly, the destructive as well as the constructive technology will grow, you see, and we get more and more imprisoned by it. There's involved also, of course, a whole judgment here that is very ubiquitous, namely that all technological development is good. Well, is it good? You see, can you make any defense whatsoever for the development of weapons, let's say, in the last 400 years? How would you justify the development of weapons? See, this question is never asked. Whenever you can invent a new weapon, you introduce it. Whenever you can go to the moon, you go to the moon. Does it mean that because a thing is technologically feasible, that we therefore ought to introduce it into the economy? Well, that's been our prevalent attitudes with the results that we've seen under points 1 and 2. Now, curiously enough, it's even true in those parts of the world that are called socialist, the Soviet Union and many other parts of the world. There's a kind of mystique about technology that even where you have instruments for socially controlled, the technology seems to be introduced because it's assumed, without proof, that all technological development is good. I'm told, for example, that the one of the most unpolluted bodies of water on the earth, Lake Baikal in the Soviet Union, is now on the verge of being industrialized. They're going to build industry near the lake. There's been a big battle between the Soviet conservationists and the Soviet industrializers. Should we move industry to Lake Baikal, which has many irreplaceable species of fish, for example, apparently? And the conservationists have been defeated. And some Soviet scholars say this is the tendency, you see, that even where you have the instruments to control technology, you don't use them. Because you're under this mystique that the more technology you develop, the more complex your technology, the better it will be. Well, I dwell on this third crisis sufficiently, I think, to illustrate the kinds of questions that will be or can be raised. Now, the last kind of crisis, it seems to me, is the crisis in attitudes and outlook. And perhaps this is the basic kind of crisis. There is an old statement, you know, whatsoever a man thinks, that is he. A man is what he thinks. A man is how he perceives the world. Now, the basic question, I suppose, at this point is that our outlooks, so to speak, are about back here, before the explosive age of technology. And we haven't shaken up those outlooks sufficiently to come to grips with the kinds of crises we've been talking about. Often in the past, we have assumed that technological development could be free or introduced primarily for immediate private gain. Now, this is a very ubiquitous attitude. Lake Erie, we say it's almost dead. Well, some people dispute that. Whether it's dead or not, it's near dead anyway. It's moribund, I suppose you could say. Now, why is Lake Erie dead? Ultimately, it goes back to a series of attitudes, ideas. The idea was that people could use the resources of Lake Erie or use it as a dumping ground for industrial waste, increase their immediate profit, you see. And they became millionaires and therefore bought into the Republican Party and the Democratic Party and gained political power, you see. And continued to dump their industrial waste in Lake Erie. And we said, oh, look at our progress. All these giant industries and the increase in standard of living, the GNP, the gross national products. Well, that's a superficial view, because in the process of gaining immediate profit, which we took to be desirable, we were destroying the chances of our children and our grandchildren to enjoy Lake Erie or even to use it, to exploit it. So that part of this problem is that we tend to think in short-run terms, you see, as human beings, and we don't think of the long run. It's true, Lord Keynes used to say, in the long run, we're all dead. And that's true. In the long run, we are all dead, but presumably our children and our grandchildren are not all dead in the long run. Well, they're not dead in our long run. They may be dead in their long runs. So that what seems to be required, among other things, is a basic change in our tendency to think in terms of immediate gain, monetary gain, and to enlarge the scope of the vision within which we look at these problems. If we establish institutional controls on technological development, what priorities should guide our decisions? Suppose we change our basic attitude, in other words, and now say that the control of technology becomes a matter of public policy, which is politics, you see. So we politicize technology.
Then we're immediately confronted with the task of which kinds of technology are we going to accept and which kinds are we going to reject and how are we going to control it. And this involves a whole series of other problems of developing the legal and the institutional techniques whereby we can control it. We're in a very primitive stage in these terms, for example. I illustrated that earlier in this talk when I talked about the Russians polluting American air and the Americans polluting the Russian air. Our political divisions are not adequate, even if we had the will to do so, to, in the present day, to control or to direct the kinds of technological developments that we've been talking about. So we're going to have to confront the possibility that of a revolution of some sort, you see, in our political outlook. Now that's one of the greatest revolutions and the most difficult revolutions to accomplish. One of the most difficult revolutions to accomplish. Take, for example, the political debate that's going on this year, alleged debate. Most of it is about trivia, not about basics. This happens in every American election. You're never debating anything fundamental, or very rarely, you see. You debate the war in Vietnam, I agree that's an important matter. But what I'd like to see us do is to get beyond the war in Vietnam, you see, and to debate this whole issue of the degree to which we want to adopt any technology of destruction. And on principle, whether we should ever introduce it. And that's a much more fundamental question. Why do we keep on building bigger and bigger weapons? We never debate that issue. We just assume that it must be done. And this applies to more primitive weapons as well as to the ungodly complicated weapons that we have today, which very few of us can understand. The problem becomes then, if we do want to direct the course of our technological development consciously and politically, because technology affects all of us, not a private matter, you see, it's a public matter. It ought to be treated publicly. Today we treat it privately. Then, if we do decide to change our attitude at that point, what orders of priority shall we establish? What values shall we apply? What technology shall we exclude, if we're going to exclude it? Can we make a distinction, for example, between medical technology, which is supposedly good, although here is a nice question too, you see, and non-medical technology, let's say. One of the problems, of course, of technological development is always that a given technique can be used both for destruction quite often and constructive purposes often. And so you have to confront that problem. And how do you measure consequences of what you're going to do and what you adopt and what you don't adopt? It's very difficult to predict consequences of a given choice. So that you get a whole series of complicated questions of this kind that can be said to arise in connection with the fourth crisis. Now, let me just use one moment now to recapitulate what I have said so that we encapsulate, so to speak, on calling the four crises. I've suggested that the first crisis had to do with the population resources problem, and that resources included both living space, so to speak, and getting a living in a way. And all the questions that are raised in connection with that. And that, of course, it was intimately connected with modern industrial development. There was the environmental crisis, which has to do with the effect of technological development and industrialism on the house within which we live, the dwelling place within which we live, nature, the air, the water, the resources, the natural resources upon which we have to build civilization, you see, ultimately. What do we do about this crisis? There was the crisis in society and politics. So often in the past, we've treated technology as a private matter, not as a public matter, subject to public policy.
But increasingly, as the crisis develops, we're compelled more and more to think of it as a public matter. That, in turn, gives rise to a whole series of other problems, some of which seem very, very difficult to resolve. And finally, there was the crisis in attitudes and outlook. Basic ideas or basic perspectives from the viewpoint of which we look at these issues. And I suggested that perhaps this was the basic crisis in a way. That we have to be willing to re-examine our older conceptions in the light of the first three crises. And that it might lead to revolution.
He kidded Hollywood and the movies just as he kidded everything else. When there was talk of the motion picture industry moving away from Hollywood to avoid taxes, this is what he said about it.
Oh, I got to tell you about the movie business. We put certain taxes on and say we're going to leave. One gentleman, Mr. Sam Golden, this morning says we're going to England.
To define some of the constituent elements that exist presumably in any political theory, beginning with the metaphysical level and ending with the level of practice or the application of conceptions. Now, there was an implicit assumption, I think, in our discussion the other day, and that is that politics, in fact, it was made very explicit, I think, that politics involves areas of choice. Presumably, things could be other than they are, just as ethics does. So that you begin by assuming that choices somehow are real, political choices. And I like to think of of the political area somewhat in this way, as a continuum, you see. Mankind developed, presumably from levels of relatively low political governance to relatively high levels. But of course, that depends on what you mean by political. By low-level political governance, we mean that at this stage, not that mankind, for the most part, were literally way back here, but we can imagine it, you see, as a stage. At this level, the governance of the community, our rule of the community, is by either instinct, our custom, our ironclad tradition. So that everything you do, this is more or less what the sociologists used to call the sacred society, isn't it? For those of you who are sociologists. Everything you do is regulated, presumably, by tradition, our ironclad custom. The way you make love, the way you eat, the way you manufacture things in the primitive sense, the way you conduct yourself with reference to your neighbor. Presumably in a situation like this, then, the level of what we might call individuality, doubt, is fairly low. Everything is laid out for it. It'd be a wonderful situation in which to exist. It's somewhat like existence in the womb, you see. Everything is fixed for you. You automatically suckle in the womb. Everything is automatic almost. Before you develop individual consciousness at a high level. Now, again, don't take this literally. Don't say there was a time necessarily when this existed with no level of political governance. But relatively low, you see.
Now, as individuality develops, and what Walter Badgett called in the 19th century the cake of custom begins to crack, there are various reasons that the cake of custom begins to crack. Individuality is released, you see, from governance by custom and tradition. And again, the analogy would be here somewhat like your growing up. Your family framework begins to crack, in a sense. You begin to doubt your family, you see, at puberty or early adolescence. Yes.
Before you go
any
further,
yeah. Okay.
I don't think I understand exactly how you're applying it to an individual's development, or are you saying...
I'm applying it right now, for the most part, to the community, to the society.
Okay, you're saying theoretically
I'm using this, perhaps this framework, as Max Weber would use an ideal type. If you know Max Weber's ideal typology, it's an abstraction, in a way, from what our experience suggests, but it's not to be taken literally. See, I'm not saying necessarily there's never been a period in which there's been no political element. All I'm saying is it's been relatively low, and that we can imagine one where there is none, you see, if you can imagine the societies ruled in this way. So I'm glad you emphasized that point. And feel free to interrupt at any point, you see, too, as you have so far. I hope you do continue to. Tradition declines, you know, governance by instinct, which we imagine conceivably might have existed because of man's kinship with the beasts, which is not novel with Darwin, of course. Aristotle is going to point out many relationships of humanity with the beasts, you see. As we move then down the continuum, we can imagine a situation in which the political is enlarged, you see. The relative degree of governance by the political is enlarged. When we say political here, we mean governance or control or direction of collective affairs consciously, rather than having that governance or control or direction at the subconscious level or the unconscious level, the level of tradition, you see. Or the level of custom or the level of instinct. You think of the human personality, you see, we often think that much of it is down here at the subconscious level. Much of it is here, some of it is here perhaps at the conscious level. We often become conscious of only a minute fraction of what's going on down here, in which case, of course, it ceases to be unconscious. Now, I'm suggesting, you see, that in terms of this typology, a similar situation exists with reference to the development of politics, the community, you see. You think of political rule or political direction as being conscious or deliberate control of collective affairs or direction of collective affairs. Then, when custom and tradition begin to crack, humanity are confronted with the problem of what they do to take the place. What can they do to take the place of custom and traditions? And it's at this point that the political problem emerges. You can no longer rely on the custom of the forefathers. It's cracked open, partly through trade and commerce. You can't go back. You can't go home again, as Thomas Wolfe called one of his old novels. Can't go home again. Now what do? At this point, when the area of indeterminacy is no longer determined by custom and tradition wholly, grows, you see, from a very narrow range to a much broader range. As this grows, then, we're forced, as we say, to think, however primitively, politically. Now, we try all sorts of methods to get out of that. We say the gods will intervene, restore the old order, you see. This is a typical reaction.
Or we say things will come out all right, the traditions of the fathers will be restored. Or we can look at the animals and see how they're governed by instinct and let's imitate them. See, that's another option at this point. See what the bees do. If we imitate the bees, then we'll solve this problem of conscious or deliberate direction of human affairs. And these have been all attempts, you see, to meet this issue. But in one way or another, we're going to have to think then about what to do about human collective affairs, one way or another, when custom and tradition begin to decline, as they do. And the more urbanized the society becomes, on the whole, the less we can rely on custom and tradition. See, no sooner do you break down an old custom and tradition than the new one tries to get established, but it cracks up immediately because of the constant change characteristic of urban life. So again, you see, this accentuates what I'm calling the political problem. How do you consciously direct collective human affairs? Now, some people will say, just let things alone, and they'll direct themselves. This is one answer. Maybe that's a variant of the answer, let the gods decide. But there's disillusionment about that answer, too. They don't automatically settle things, you see, if you just let things alone. All sorts of problems arise with that kind of an answer. So you're thrown back to the basic problem again, which is the underlying political problem. How do you consciously or deliberately direct human, I'll use the term now, evolution? Or can you direct human evolution? You can't rely on accident. You can't rely on custom and tradition anymore. And the more you move away from primitive nature, the more you move away from primitive nature, living close to the soil, other things being equal, the more magnified the political problem becomes. Now, this doesn't mean that still a large part of the life of mankind is not governed by custom and tradition. It still is, of course. But the relative size or the relative magnitude of the political problem, it expands. Just as when we enter adult life, the relative problem of making our own decisions one way or another expands, you see, as compared to what it was when we were 7 years old. See, I'm trying to draw an analogy, don't press it too far, between our own personal experience and the experience of the communities. So this is what we're going to think of as the political. Now, partly, you see, the political problem is connected with the growth of what we call consciousness. Too. The perspective that we bring to these matters, consciousness, as consciousness grows, awareness grows of what is taking place, the political problem, the problem of consciously directing collective affairs, grows with it. There's a kind of mutual stimulation, as it were, between the breakdown of custom and tradition and the development of awareness. What that relationship is, of course, is the subject of much theoretical speculation. It doesn't begin with Marx. See, Marx is not the first one who talks in these terms. It's a very old problem in the history of political speculation.
Yeah. When you say
a human being has plant-like qualities and animal-like qualities. I guess we'd all agree with that.
Yep.
We're very much like a cabbage in some respects, and we're also very much like a rat. I think we'll all agree with that. Now, if we're governed by our cabbage characteristics, we simply grow without thought, presumably, if the external conditions are right. We don't reflect. We don't reflect at all.
Perhaps as rats we do a little bit more. But even so, animal passions for the most part govern us when we're rats, in our rat-like characteristics. Now, the point is that as you move into what we call distinctively human situations, we first tend to be a part of a custom-governed community, tradition and custom. And then we break out of that at the community level, and we reach then this question, or we reach this problem of political direction instead of customary direction. Now, the scope, the consciousness of the scope of what is political will vary, you see. What is truly political, what we can consciously control, or can consciously direct. And this is part of the problem of political thought. In many respects, let's say the Greek philosophers were much more aware of the political problem than most of us. What was the essentially political problem? That's why we still read them, I assume, because we think we can learn from them. But the general consciousness in any age will differ from the political consciousness of perhaps a few individuals. Today, for example, how many human beings think that war is a natural event? This has been characteristic of many human beings throughout history, you see. War is simply a natural event like a hurricane or a tornado. Can't do anything about it. It comes. It breaks out. It's not human beings who break it out. It just breaks out. We still use that language, don't we? Now, if you think of war as simply a natural event, in your consciousness, it has nothing to do with politics. It's just simply natural. Because by definition, the political problem arises when you believe you can do something about it. Or take again the issue of technology, about which we'll have something to say in connection with Greek political thought. It's been typical in the last 150 years in the United States, I think, to think that technology is a given, technological development. It's ordained by the stars. And so all you can do politically about it, and all you ought to do politically about it, is to adjust to it. You hear that expression all the time, don't you? You hear people say, in the coming generation, we will go to Mars. Now how do we adjust our consciousness to that? Well, for a different perspective, a person who has a different political consciousness will say, why do we take technological development for granted? And why do we want to adjust to it? Why don't we force it to adjust to us? You see. So that how we perceive the political problem will vary widely from person to person.